quickly. Thereafter, I will then give you an opportunity to introduce yourself briefly, because members have also got an opportunity of looking at your CV and all that. Without breaking between, that brief intro will be also to introduce your topic on the 10 minutes presentation, Max. Not sure. We'll then take members to engage with you. Again, there it will be 5 minutes maximum, which includes both the questions or any matter that the member raises and your response, and then move towards the closure of the session. Having clarified that, we on my right we have got Honorable Kubeka. We then have Honorable Mulala, Honorable Faku, Honorable Fandam, Honorable Dr. Ndlozi, Honorable Maneli Chering, as I said, Honorable Machoze to attend to the appointment matter. In that score, that covers the brief introduction of the members so that you know we are engaging with. I will now afford you, Mr. Professor, the opportunity to briefly introduce yourself and get to the topic that you want to engage the committee on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here this afternoon. As I say, my name is Lyndon Petzer. I have been around this industry for more than 40 years. I started my career at the SABC as a technician. I then, in 1994, when the Independent Broadcasting Authority was established, I got the position as the head of the technical division of the Independent Broadcasting Authority, and I spent 4 years there establishing the infrastructure needed for the technical division of the Independent Broadcasting Authority. In 1998, there was a reduction of staff at the IBA, and I was one of those retrenched. I then established my own consultancy on spectrum management and regulatory affairs, where to a large extent I was dealing with satellite regulatory issues, and during that period I undertook a number of missions on behalf of the International Telecommunication Union development sector in Africa. In 2008, a position became available at the then Department of Communications as Chief Director of Radio and Satellite Communication. I applied for that position and was successful, and spent from 2008 until March last year as the Chief Director of Radio and Satellite Communications, first at Department of Communications and later at the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services. While at DTPS, one of my last functions was to develop a strategy for a communication satellite for South Africa, and that is still work in progress. When my contract expired at DTPS in March last year, I resumed my consultancy and was involved in the preparations for the ITU World Radio Communication Conference, which took place in Egypt at the end of last year. And I'm now continuing with my consultancy work. Thank you, Chair.
As I said, you can be the topic.
Chair, thank you. Which brings us to the institutional approach to telecommunication regulation, which is one of the topics proposed. I must apologize that this presentation was prepared in a great hurry because I got very little notice that the committee wanted such a presentation, but nevertheless I've prepared some talking points here which we can go through. So Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, I think the first issue is why do we need regulation? And there are a number of issues. First of all, I think if one looks at the history of regulation, it started in a monopolistic environment where you had a single regulator, and a lot of the early regulation was around standards and compatibility of standards, particularly between various countries. As the market has developed, the need for regulation has changed, and really the primary focus of regulation at the moment is around effective competition of services, the protection of consumer interests, increased access to technologies and services, and also importantly, the management of scarce resources. In this regard, one looks at the radio frequency spectrum, where the demand for spectrum far exceeds the amount of spectrum that is available, but at the same time, one also cannot just flood the market with services. You will have, it's a recipe for market failure, where organizations will start with services, sign up consumers, and you then find that the enterprise folds and you have consumers without services. So consumer protection, competition, technology of standards, and management of scarce resources are really the primary objects of regulation. And regulation is not just for regulation's sake, where you're making life difficult for the industry. The issues to regulate, and I've brought this into the South African context, in that we talk about the regulation of network services and infrastructure, the regulation of communication services, importantly, the regulation and management of the radio frequency spectrum, which, as I've just said, the demand far exceeds the amount of spectrum that is available. Technical parameters, transmission characteristics are a very important fact that we have well thought out standards, quality standards, and compatible standards as well, so that in broadcasting or in mobile telephony, we don't sit with a multitude of standards which makes particularly consumer equipment difficult, in that consumers would need multiple handsets or so on. And importantly, and as is emphasized in our local legislation, is that the regulation should be in the public interest. I think it's important to touch on the international regulatory regime just very briefly. And honorable members, you are all aware that the International Telecommunication Union is the specialized UN agency responsible for ICTs. It is the oldest international organization, having been established in 1868 as the International Telegraph Union. And the purpose of that was really standardization of telegraph issues between countries in Europe. And at that stage, they had already realized the importance of standardization. To my mind, a very important issue is Article 44 of the ITU Constitution. And the ITU Constitution is an international treaty. We as South Africa are signatory to that treaty and are bound by it. And Article 44 of the Constitution states that the radio frequency spectrum and the associated satellite orbits, including the geostationary satellite orbit, which is used for satellite communications, are limited natural resources. They must be used rationally, efficiently, and economically in conformity with the radio regulations, which again, the ITU radio regulations are an international treaty. It goes further to say that countries have equitable access to satellite orbits and the spectrum, and that the special needs of developing countries must be taken into account. Now, the issue of efficient use of spectrum and economic use of spectrum, I think, is quite clearly understood by everyone. There's been a lot of debate about what the rational use of spectrum means. And essentially, the view is that the rational use of spectrum is that you don't use more spectrum or hoard more spectrum than what you actually need. So, to some extent, the rational use of spectrum and the efficient use of spectrum are connected. Moving on very quickly to the generic characteristics of an effective regulator, and I've listed three issues here. The first is structural independence, the second is financial independence, and the third issue is the functionality of the regulator. In South Africa, I believe that we are very fortunate. We have an independent regulator. By independence, we are talking about independent of political interference, and we are also talking about independent from influence by the various licensees or various operators that the regulator is required to regulate. And this can sometimes be rather difficult. When we come to financial independence, again, quite a controversial subject, because if government has the power to determine the regulator's budget, the regulator can be susceptible to political interference if there are not other checks and balances in place. Funding should be free from political and private sector influence, and ideally your regulator should be funded by the license fees that it collects, and license fees should not be a tax on the sector, but should be used to fund the regulator. Having said that, I don't believe that the regulator can set license fees in an ad hoc manner in order to boost its income. There should still be checks and balances in the way that the regulator would need to submit a budget to the oversight authority, which budget should be approved, but that the regulator should then be adequately funded from the license fees that it does collect. When we look at functionality of the regulator, there should be very well-defined functions and responsibilities. And again, I think in the South African context, we are fortunate in that both in the ICASA Act and the Electronic Communications Act, the functions and responsibilities of the regulator are very clearly set out. The regulator should be adequately resourced, and it should have competent staff. And I think these last two areas are possibly areas where in South Africa some attention is needed. For as long as I can remember, since the establishment of ICASA, there's been talk about ICASA must be adequately resourced. Again, in the Minister of Finance's budget speech yesterday, there was talk about adequate resourcing for ICASA, and this is certainly an area that does require attention. Looking at the various policy instruments in South Africa, the National Development Plan, the Integrated ICT Policy White Paper, as far as their pronouncements on ICT regulation, the first issue is that ICT is a critical enabler of economic activity. And again, The Minister of Finance, in his budget vote yesterday, made mention of the fact that the ICT sector contributed real growth to the South African economy in the previous financial year. That institutional arrangements to manage the ICT environment need to be better structured to ensure South Africa does not fall victim to a digital divide. This is a direct quote from the National Development Plan. And I think, honourable members, you are all aware of the digital divide that does exist. And this is something that we really need to work on to improve this. Even in the urban areas, there is a problem. We need improved regulatory performance for national development. And many of these are that the regulators have two challenges, or two main challenges. There are, of course, a host of other challenges. Adequate levels of investment are needed to provide reliable services. Unfortunately, ICT infrastructure is expensive. And in the context of South Africa, where ICT infrastructure is largely in the hands of the private sector, we don't have a strong state-owned entity providing ICT infrastructure as yet. This is a problem. And the second challenge is that pricing levels need to be managed. We all want the cheapest possible ICT services, but again, at the same time, given the South African context where private sector is responsible for the provision of ICT infrastructure, at the same time, the regulator needs to protect the interests of the ICT service providers. Moving on to the Integrated ICT Policy White Paper, again, reiterates, I think, what we all know, is that effective regulation is a critical contributor to fostering investment and innovation. Currently, there are overlaps and duplication of roles. If you look at, you've got ICASA, you've got the ZA Domain Name Authority, you've also got USASA that has certain regulatory functions. And the ICT policy white paper actually proposed a new regulator that would rationalize some of these functions, and it was called an economic regulator rather than an ICT regulator in the white paper. My understanding is that government is working on legislation to enact this. This new regulator would be responsible for electronic communication services, network services, issue spectrum assignments, and yeah, there is a large deviation from the existing regulatory environment. Currently, ICASA is responsible for all aspects of spectrum management. The ICT policy white paper proposes that government should be responsible for the policy aspects of spectrum, such as the allocation of spectrum to services, and the ICASA role should be restricted to the licensing and monitoring of spectrum. And honourable members, you are all aware there's been a lot of debate in the media around this particular aspect, and I'm quite happy to engage on this later if necessary. The new envisaged regulator should be responsible for ex-ante competition regulation across ICT and internet value change. Again, internet is not really regulated at the moment apart from domain names. And very importantly, once again, the regulator needs to be responsible for consumer protection. Honourable Chair, members, this is my final slide. Regulatory imperatives for ICASA. I think one of the primary issues and one of the very urgent issues is that an impact assessment on the licensing of the WOAN is necessary. Again, this is something that's controversial within the ICT policy white paper, and I believe that a regulatory impact on what the implications of this to the market, to competition, has not been done, and it needs to be done. The release of the digital dividend spectrum is something which, again, is way overdue. I began the digital television broadcasting process in 2003. As you're all aware, there was an international conference in 2004 and 2006 which developed the frequency plan for digital terrestrial television, and that conference stated that analog transmission should be switched off in 2015. Well, we are 5 years down the line, and we are a very long way from having done that. And once analog is switched off, there still needs to be a digital-to-digital migration to release that digital dividend spectrum. And the digital dividend spectrum is absolutely critical to the provision of mobile broadband services, particularly in rural areas, which again will help to alleviate the digital divide. Something else that needs attention is a review of the current spectrum pricing methodology. The current spectrum pricing methodology was adopted in 2008, and it is based on an administrative incentive pricing model, which is a good model, but it needs updating. There are various factors involved in this model, which I don't want to go into now, but with new technologies where you've got very wide bandwidths that are used, such as for enhanced mobile broadband services in the millimeter waves and also for satellite communication, the spectrum pricing methodology breaks down and spectrum prices are just no longer affordable. So this is something that really needs attention. Importantly, we need, as the regulator and in South Africa, to continue our participation in international and regional regulatory forums to make our voice heard. We are a leader on the continent. We need to continue that leadership role without it being a dominance role. So we need to achieve that balance between leadership and the perception being created that we are trying to dominate the regulatory environment. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petzer. We'll now take questions, Honourable Members, starting with Honourable Kubeka on this one.
Good day, Dr. Linden. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Yes, even myself, I'm very good. I can hear with a low voice that is presenting. But thank you for your presentation. Can hear that indeed, as you have presented yourself, we are speaking from somebody who's having an experience actually here in this industry. Dr. Linden, one of the key objectives of the policy directives on high demand spectrum is to promote and also to facilitate entry by new players into the market in order to deal with the duopoly structure of the market. Do you believe that the information memorandum published by ICASA facilitates entry by new players. If no, why not? If yes, how does it do so? I'll come up.
Yes,
Honourable Chair, do you want me to respond?
Yes.
To each? Okay, thank you very much, Honourable Kubeka. It's a very interesting question, and I agree that we need to promote entry by new players into the market. Now, the question is, where do we want these new players to come in? The WOAN is one mechanism by which it can be done. Whether the WOAN is an appropriate mechanism to do it, I have some doubts. I have been in this industry long enough to remember the underserviced area licensee debacle. I think honourable members around this room are too young to have known that, but I'm sure you have read about the underserviced area licensees. We do not want a repeat of that. A lot of money was lost, a lot of emerging and unfortunately historically disadvantaged companies went under as a result of that, and we must avoid that at all costs. And that is why I was saying that we need an impact assessment on the WOAN. The other issue is ICT infrastructure is expensive. Where should emerging players play? Is it at the services level or at the infrastructure level? My personal view is emerging players should come in at the service level. This is where the opportunities lie. We need some sort of centralized infrastructure, and what that is, we need to determine. And unfortunately, the information memorandum does not really provide clarity on that. So my view would be is, let's bring emerging players in at the services level, where there's a lot of scope for innovation. We've got a lot of very clever young people in South Africa with applications, various applications. Let's look at competing at that level. And I'm not saying that they mustn't play at the infrastructure level. Certainly they can. But what we need is a backbone. And that at the infrastructure level for emerging players, it should be at the level of the last mile connectivity in the local area. So you have local people providing the service to their own people, because they best know the needs of the people that they are serving. Thank you.
We are also having this idea of converging the entities. According to you, do you think it's advisable to converge the entities, or we can just leave just like that?
Sorry, Honourable Kubeka. When you speak of entities, which entities are we talking about converting?
That are in this industry, especially here under the ICASA, as we are having these ones, the ICASA and the FPB, and also the Zedna there. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification, Honourable Quebec. I think as far as ICASA, Internet, the Domain Name Authority, I do not see a problem with merging those. I have some concerns about merging the Forms and Publications Board into ICASA. I think that requires regulation of a different nature. So USASA, ICASA, Domain Name Authority, a new internet regulator are okay, but I would have some concerns about the Forms and Publications Board being part of a converged regulator.
The last one. On the side of the ICASA, we know that there's a certain portion that it falls under, according to the Constitution, Section 192, about the independency. Are you saying we can just be just like that, standing there, whilst we are talking about these things of converging? Is it advisable to leave ICASA, as we know that on the side of the broadcasting it falls under that Section 192?
Honourable Kubeka, this is also another pet of mine. As you correctly say, Section 192 states that there shall be an independent broadcast regulator. And that section was written in during the democratic negotiations to ensure that there would be a plethora of voices and that we would not have state-controlled broadcasting. Personally, I do not believe that Section 192 extends to telecommunications. Section 192 is clear. There shall be an independent broadcast regulator, not a telecommunications regulator. And in fact, that is where you had the IBA and SATRA established in the early mid-1990s. And as with the merger of IBA and SATRA to form ICASA, the Section 192 has now become applicable to the whole of ICASA, which I believe was not the intention of the authors of the Constitution.
Honourable Fanda.
Thanks, Chair. Morning, afternoon. Afternoon, Mr. Linden. I'm really, I'm going to carry on where my colleague left. I'm really fascinated by your opinion that ICASA shouldn't be merged with the FPB. That was the opinion, right? If it was, do you think there would be any constitutional implications if ICASA was merged with FPB and the ZA domain name? What constitutional implications would there be?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Honourable Van Damme. I don't believe that there would be constitutional implications with the domain merger with the Domain Name Authority, because that is largely a technical issue. But yes, there could definitely be freedom of speech issues associated with the merger with the Forms and Publications Board. And as I say, my understanding of the intention of Section 192 was to create a wide variety and a plethora of voices on content. And it may not be the case, but this would be have to be something that is very carefully monitored, in that the Forms and Publications Board could, and I'm not saying it will, it could restrict freedom of speech.
I think I agree with you there. So do you believe that there should be online regulation? Particularly what the FPB does or try to do. Should there be regulation of what happens online? Or should there just be freedom of speech?
I don't think any freedom, be it freedom of speech, be it freedom of association, be it is unrestricted. There need to be limits. The problem with online regulation is, how does one do it? There are ways of getting around much or a lot of content is sourced internationally. How are you going to restrict it? Is it practically possible? Yes, one doesn't want to see violence against women and children. One doesn't want to see child pornography. But what are the mechanisms to control it? Honourable members will be aware that before OTT services such as Netflix were available in South Africa, people were getting access to them through, if I could call it, back doors, creating virtual private networks, offshore accounts, and so on. Now, does one want to spend a lot of time and effort policing something which, are the returns worthwhile? Or is the extent of what you are trying to police worth the effort? How much is that? And perhaps an assessment needs to be done on this. But my personal view is that one is really fighting a losing battle there. I don't think it can be done. You may be able to control it to some extent, but by putting certain blocks in, you could be infringing legitimate content.
Would you agree that there shouldn't be any regulation? So if I post something that is incitement, there's the Department of Justice, there's the police. It should be measured according to the harm. If there's child pornography, there's different organizations that deal with that. So there shouldn't be any body or any legislation in the Department of Communications that does online regulation.
I don't think there should be no online regulation. There needs to be a degree of regulation, but as you correctly say, there are other bodies that deal with it. If it's a case of cyberbullying or slander or something, there are mechanisms to do it. But unfortunately, these are regulations after the fact.
Okay, what do you mean some regulations? Would you explain just what that practically would be?
Perhaps regulation is not the correct term. One needs a framework that people would need to adhere to. So child pornography, violence against women and children, hate speech should not be allowed. And if it is, these are the penalties. But I think what I'm trying to say is don't try and block this. Set a regulatory framework, which I think already probably exists in the justice system for these. But I don't believe that a regulator could prohibit or block or stop such content.
Honourable Fad.
Mr. Petra, thank you for your presentation. It was informative. I enjoyed it. But part of your presentation, I just have three questions. You are saying that the integrated ICT policy, white paper policy, Land proposed that policy must remain with the department and licensing must remain with ICASA. What is your view regarding that? Because I could hear that you have a different view with regards to that.
Honourable Faku, no, and if I gave that impression, I must apologise. I strongly believe that spectrum policy is a function of government. So if I can go into a little bit of detail, at an ITU conference, and again, please indulge me, Honourable Chair, the ITU being a UN body, decisions are made by the members. So this is not some bunch of people sitting in a dark office in Geneva making decisions. Decisions are made at conferences which are held approximately every 4 years, and the ITU member states make decisions. What would happen is a particular frequency band would be allocated to, for example, the mobile service for mobile broadband and for broadcasting services. It then becomes a function of national government to decide, given that country's socio-economic requirements, political requirements, are we going to use that frequency band for broadcasting, or are we going to use it for mobile services? So that's where I believe the political decision lies, in the allocation of spectrum. The regulator would then say, okay, given that government has said in South Africa this particular frequency band will be used for broadcasting, we now invite license applications from prospective broadcasters to provide services in that band.
Thank you. My follow-up question is, do you think we are ready to release the spectrum with the proposed date that is input?
Honourable Faku, to be very blunt, no.
How long will it take us?
Well, sorry, not if we do terrestrial television. If we were going to say we will do away with terrestrial television, we will go satellite, it is probably possible. The challenge that we are sitting with in South Africa is, I think we are probably the first country in the world where we have established a national terrestrial transmission network for digital television, but we've got no receivers in the market. And there are various reasons for this. In 2008, when this process started, set-top box were going to be the answer, because there was no other technology available. 12 years later, you have got integrated digital television receivers. Set-top boxes are really not the answer anymore. Integrated digital television receivers are the answer. They are coming down in price. We have seen what's happened with the whole digital migration process. I was part of the Digital Migration Advisory Council to the Minister when I was still at the Department of Telecoms and Postal Services, and it's not happening. There's now a new model, a voucher system that's been proposed. Retailers are not prepared to stock digital terrestrial television set-top boxes or decoders. They will stock television satellite set-top boxes because there is a market for that. But if you, and this was something that the DOC's Digital Migration Office had engagements with retailers, and they said we are not interested in, because we must remember there are two markets here. There is the subsidized market, which comprises, at some stage it was about 5 to 6 million households, and then there is the unsubsidized terrestrial market, and then you've got the satellite market. Currently, my understanding is there are about 14 to 15 million television households in South Africa. Of those, around 8 million are currently already on satellite. One of the other issues, sorry, Honourable Fox, is that there is an imbalance of services between terrestrial television and satellite television. So, of course, people are going to want the satellite television, which offers more services.
No, I'm going to put you in a corner. You know, our government has invested a lot in this set of boxes. What is your advice? What is the way forward? But at the end of the day, we have to use those set of boxes that are sitting in the post office. What do you think is the right direction to go? But let me just summarize my second question. I see you also speak about the review of spectrum prices methodology. Can you school me a little bit with regards to that? My last one is the issue of transformation. If given an opportunity, what would you do? Because some people have a view there's a certain grouping that is dominating the sector. If given an opportunity, what can you do different? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Regarding the set-top boxes that are there, we can't just dump them. They need to be rolled out. But we need to be very careful in how we do this. I mentioned earlier that we are the first country in the world to have a national transmission network for terrestrial television. Some of those transmitters were installed as far back as 2008. Those transmitters are running. They've never brought in 1 cent of income. Those transmitters will soon be will need replacement. Now, are we going to throw good money after bad? Or how are we going to go about this issue? It is a major problem. I agree the set-top boxes that are there need to be distributed, but we need to have a very rational plan as to how they are going to be distributed. Speaking from my days on the Digital Migration Advisory Council, installers would go out and households would say, but I don't want a terrestrial box, I want a satellite box. My neighbor's got a satellite box and he's getting more programs than I am. With regard to your question on spectrum pricing, this becomes a very technical issue in that your administrative incentive pricing model takes various factors into account, such as depending on which frequency band you have, there's a weighting factor. Depending on the geographic area you are in, there's another factor. Depending on the bandwidth you occupy, you have an additional factor. And then you have a basic spectrum price per unit of spectrum. So if you are in Gauteng, you may be paying 3 times what you would be paying in a rural area in the Eastern Cape, because the demand for spectrum in the rural area in the Eastern Cape is not that great. Similarly, there would be in a frequency band, if you are in one of the so-called high demand spectrum bands, you would be paying more than you would if you were in a 30 gigahertz band where there's not a lot of demand. Then you have a bandwidth issue. So if you are using mobile broadband at 3 gigahertz, you would be paying a certain price. If you were providing real 5G services at 60 gigahertz where you need a lot of spectrum, you would be paying 100 times that price. One of the other issues that comes in is the area that you cover. So if you are covering 1 kilometer radius, you would pay so much. If you are covering 10 kilometers, you might pay 100 times that price. And this is where the big problem comes in when you get to satellite, because 1 satellite covers the whole country. So your geographic coverage area is so large that your spectrum pricing just becomes impossible. With regard to your transformation question, this is something that needs serious attention. I am currently busy with a project which I don't want to mention, but I was in a meeting on Tuesday, and Everybody was my age, everybody was my color. In the ICT, there's been a lot of transformation, but yes, it is still white, it is still male dominated, and things need to be done. Now, if one looks at ICASA regulations, the ICASA regulations state that any licensee must comply with the double B triple E codes, there must be 30% historic disadvantaged ownership. I don't believe that one of the major licensees complies with that criteria. So that is something that needs to be sorted out very urgently. Thank you.
Honorable Dr. Ntlozi.
Thanks. I want to pick up on your age and your color. Why must we put you in ICASA, seeing that you've admitted that the industry is people who are generally old and white? So why must we also do the same thing?
Thank you, thank you very much, Honorable Ntlozi. My color, I can't do anything about. My age, again, I can't do anything about. However, my age gives me a lot of experience. I've built up a lot of knowledge over the years, and this is knowledge which should not die. And I'm very willing to share this knowledge with anybody who wants.
Why don't you write a book?
That is perhaps an option, Honorable Ntlozi.
So must we then agree you are going to go write a book? We are not going to put you in ICASA.
Honorable Ntlozi, I'm in your hands when it comes to that, but I believe that I can still play a role in taking this country forward, improving the regulator. If I write a book, people may read it, they may buy it, or they may buy it and just put it on a shelf and not read it. But if I am in ICASA, I believe that I can make a difference to this country.
What were you doing in the SABC when you started? What role were you playing?
I was a technician doing microwave installations in the outside broadcast environment, that we were putting up links to provide sports transmissions from the stadiums to be transmitted.
When was this?
That was 1977 to 1979. Then I moved on to a division that was within the SABC, which is now Centec, was responsible for transmitter network planning, and that's where I first became involved in the regulatory side of things, where we planned the SABC transmission network, where transmitters should be built, the powers that they should be on, and so on. From that division spun off to become Centec, and that planning function in 1994 then became the mandate of the Independent Broadcasting Authority.
We were part of the regime's ability to exclude majority of our people in the broadcasting industry. You were its technical expert.
Honorable Ntlozi, if I, and I trust that the freedom of speech issues will extend to me here, in the previous regime, I was seen as a Donnerse Engelsman.
Donnerse Engelsman?
Engelsman. So I was English, so I wasn't part of the fold. And you could only, within the SABC, if you were not an Afrikaner, you only reached a certain level of level within the hierarchy, because you were English, I mean, that discrimination is nothing like the majority of our.
So you wanted to rise, but because you were English, you couldn't rise.
Correct.
So you wanted to serve at the highest level of this regime. It's just you were English. Never had any problems with serving in this regime.
No, I did have problems. If I can again,
let me put it this way. You know, I thought these people have been crying about me being diplomatic. I'm really trying to give you an opportunity to demonstrate that you've got a sense of conscience and strong sense of justice. Because ICASA sort of plays like a Chapter 9 institution which guards this democracy. So people of real conviction, in my view, should ascend at the level at which you are applying. So I need to get a sense that you are driven by justice and you are passionate about this democracy. And because you've got this history of compliance and complicity with apartheid, I'm disrupted. So I'm giving you an opportunity to address that.
Thank you, I understand. I believe that what happened during apartheid is inexcusable. I mean, we all agree that apartheid was a crime against humanity. I grew up in a household where our philosophy was the National Party are all a bunch of traitors. They should have all been shot in 1945 before they even came to power. Having said that, the home environment where I grew up, there was never a case of any discrimination at all.
So people of your age in Britain, in Australia, in the US, participated in the anti-apartheid movement as distant as they were, put their bodies online, white people, to stop the rugby team in New Zealand from playing so that they demonstrate their rejection of apartheid. Not now, when the apartheid is gone. So the statement you just made might have landed you in prison, for an example. But you didn't make it then because you were working for the SABC and
not,
it was
not
nice.
Not at all. When I was at university, I was friends with Dr. Rick Turner, Charles Newton.
You went to UKZN.
I had been beaten around the head by the police where we were protesting.
Did participate in the strike.
I did participate, and as I say, I don't have the scars, but
I've got the Rick Turner's circle was often a strong one. Okay, so DTT advice. What was your view on encryption when you were advising Mutambi?
One needs to go back to the purpose of DTT, and this goes back to 2008, when the whole issue of the set-top boxes started. At that stage, I was not yet at DOC, I was still consulting. And representatives from DOC came to a meeting of the South African Bureau of Standards and said, we have this project where we are starting with digital terrestrial television.
My apologies, boxes. Mr. Linden.
Yeah.
I just need a sharp answer.
Yeah,
they're going to stop me just now. What was your view on encryption?
The issue was that government wanted set-top boxes to be made in South Africa solely and to revive the South African electronics industry. And they wanted a mechanism as to how this could be done. And it was then agreed that there would be what was called set-top box control. It was not encryption. That would protect local manufacturers in building set-top boxes, and only local manufacturers would get the key to that set-top box control. The set-top box control then morphed into an encryption debate, which it should never have done. Encryption on a free-to-air set-top box is a contradiction in terms. But the original intention was a control mechanism that would ensure local manufacture and revival of the local industry, which was a good. The unintended consequence is that it morphed into encryption, and we all know where we are 20 years later. We still don't have DTT.
Okay, final one. Internet is the future of broadcasting, no doubt. And the consequences are very clear when it comes to regulation. What are your ideas? People who come here, who have been coming, have not adequately dealt with this question. They understand the problem, but they don't know what must happen. I think that those who are taking the reins of ICASA now will be faced immediately with having to answer this urgent question. How do you regulate online broadcasting, seeing that there's no licensing powers and licensing regime? I can go start a broadcast. Now, a radio or a television or visual or voice, how would we start regulating online broadcasting?
Honorable Ntlozi.
In a way that is enforceable, like at the moment the enforcement relates to licensing conditions and so on and so forth. So now, if I don't need that, I can just simply go online, start a radio because I've got studios and all of that. I know you understand that, though. So don't tell me what the problem is. How would we start recommending, or what would be the framework of regulation, in your view, for online broadcast?
It's a problem, as you correctly say, and as you could start your online broadcasting from a neighboring country, you needn't even be in South Africa, and I can access it and you could set it. So you cannot control the content unless you are going to block the internet, which creates its own.
So any of you, we must give up?
No, I'm not saying we must give up.
What must happen?
You've got to set the parameters, and if someone is found to go beyond those parameters or to violate the framework that you've set up, then you need to use other mechanisms to deal with that person. But my personal view is...
What mechanisms? What?
If it's hate speech, DOJ, if it's...
Yeah, let's say I'm found to be in violation, for instance, of the Broadcasting Code of Conduct, and I'm broadcasting online. What must happen to me? Because under these conditions of the regulator now, if you violate the licensing conditions, we can either fine you, direct you to remove the content. If you don't comply, ultimately we withdraw the license and shut you down. What happens with online? Why must that apply to online broadcasters?
It can't apply to online broadcasters.
Why?
How are you going to control it?
There is no code of conduct. I get you. Let me do this. What must happen? What is going to happen? Are you saying we must give up on regulation if the entire broadcasting industry moves to online?
No. You would have a framework to say, this is content that is acceptable, this is content that is not acceptable. If you are found to be in contravention of content that is not acceptable, there would be other mechanisms through the courts or the Department of Justice or whoever that will deal with you.
But when you get to a court, they say you are wrong. You see, if you do a crime, I can put you in a prison. The court will do that. Leave me. I mean, maybe when I keep saying me, you think I mean politician.
No, I understand.
But what would happen to a... What would be the implication, the sort of punishment mechanism if you don't comply for online broadcasters?
That,
since you don't think we can shut you down.
No, that would have to be within that framework, that regulatory framework, that if you are found guilty in a court of promoting hate speech, distributing child pornography, you will be prosecuted under that relevant legislation and you will end up in jail. It won't be a case of taking your license away, because if you have some sort of license, you close me down here today and tomorrow I'll start somewhere else.
You're done.
In fact, I've gone more than the allocated time, because maybe you thought you donated Machozo's time. But, let's get back in the next 10 minutes to complete. Honorable Blan.
Yeah, thanks. Mr. Peter Linden, I like the Africans that you use. He was a donor of art.
Engelsman.
At least it's not me who's using that language. Yeah, thanks. on your presentation, I'm interested in two areas where you talked about protecting consumer interest, and avoiding market failure. I want you to elaborate more on the first one, protecting consumer interest, because just in line with what Honorable Lewis was raising, in this instance, our interest is the consumer and the general public out there. Now, this internet is going across borders. It's going across state authorities, going against even politics. And now, a vulnerable person in the villages, we are saying they must all have access. We're talking about universal access. But we're not talking about the impact of that access on our society generally. What type of education are these... what this access to information mean for them. So I want you to comment on that. The second one, so that I don't eat a lot of time. You have 40 years experience, and in your interaction, if you could tell me, with that huge experience and knowledge, how many black people or of African origin so far you can claim to have empowered so that we know for a fact that indeed you will be responding to Honorable Ndlozi's question, but in a different context, so that we know so far, since you've been in this industry and you yourself are confirming that it's dominated by old white Nice. It's not me who said that. It's you. Now tell me what you have done so far to ensure that thing changes. I think those are my two questions.
You can use the remaining minutes in the five to do that.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Honorable Malala, thank you. I think when we talk about protection of consumer interests, it covers a whole host of issues. Pricing is protecting the consumer interest. Access to information, access to services protects the consumer interest. The ensuring that consumers are not subjected to content that they don't want to receive is also protecting the consumer interest. And by that, the consumer must have a choice. If you switch on, for example, the SABC, you should not be confronted by content that offends you. If you want to watch certain content, you must have the choice to select that content and to access that content. But it shouldn't be forced upon you. But the important issues are the access to content of your choice at a price that you can afford. And that's where I believe that the thrust of consumer protection exists. And then, as I say, if you want to access certain content, it must be a physical or a decisive choice on your part that you wish to access that content that is not thrust upon you. We have seen market failure, fortunately not much in South Africa, but there have been a couple. The underserviced area licensees, which I referred to previously, are an example of that. Another example, which is not confined to South Africa, but when I was consulting in the early 2000s, I was in an African country, and the regulator in that country had opened up the whole spectrum to a multitude of players, which resulted in a total failure of the market because none of the licensees had sufficient spectrum to provide a service. So the result was that there was just no service. They didn't have enough. So one's got to be careful. Competition is good, but you've got to have a degree of control about the competition that you put into a market. With respect to your empowerment question, I'm very glad to say that a protege of mine who was at the DTPS is now the South African representative at the ITU in Geneva. And this is a man that I took under my wing when I started at the DTPS, and he has now progressed. He is recognized internationally as someone, as a world expert on spectrum. There were two ladies within the DTPS as well. One of them is... the one person, the guy in Geneva, is Mr. Silulami Doi. There's a lady who's still at DTPS, Ms. Cynthia Lesufi, who was also involved in spectrum management. She then moved into the DTPS policy division to get promotion. There was another lady there by the name of Ms. Jackie Shlongwane, who's no longer in government. She resigned about 2 years ago, where she was running within the ICT policy white paper. There's a policy on rapid deployment of electronic communication facilities. That was one of my projects at the DTPS. And Ms. Shlongwane was working within my section, and she was really an administrative person. I took her up where she was running that rapid deployment program. She was going out on her own to meet with stakeholders outside, engaging with them, setting up meetings, getting policy decisions made from external stakeholders, and I'm talking now of big companies in the ICT field.
Just to follow up on the first one, I think I got your responses, except for the latter part of the content. You spoke about prices, access to services, it's fine. But we've just been discussing the issue of OTTs. Honorable Nzosi has just been raised. Not regulated, no tax, no even boundaries that you're talking about. Now, in this instance, how do we then mitigate against the public interest?
The context there is that you need to make a conscious decision that you want to access that content, that it is not thrust upon you. Because unfortunately, we can't regulate it. There must be penalties if the content is there and it's freely available, but you must make a conscious decision that you want to access that content. It must not be thrust upon you.
I understand you, but what you are talking about, SABC state-owned, it's fine. This one is local. I'm talking about internet, the area where we don't have control. With SABC, it's easy. But in areas where we don't have control, what would be your proposal except to propose that we have parameters, which we don't have? So my worry is that area, that's a gray area that I think both of us need to talk to.
It's a major problem because, you know, there are sites on the internet which say they are age restricted, but you can put in a false date of birth and nobody checks it. The problem is that much of the internet content can originate outside of South Africa. It cannot be controlled. You're sitting with something which, to my mind, I can't see how you control it, honestly.
Honorable Mlala, maybe just in a minute or two. You said you were in the advisory committee of the minister on the digital migration, the DMAC.
That is correct, yes, Honorable Chair.
You are saying that, in your view, newcomers should be at a service level because the part about the infrastructure, there are issues. And the idea has been that one will play that gap where then they will anchor from that point. And your view says you don't think one will achieve such. You will need probably an impact assessment study before that. And on the other hand, there are some timelines put for spectrum. I hear to what you said as a response, what you think about spectrum. But as a person who advises, my question would be, if that's what you believe in, is it your view that probably there's no real space in this market for new players at that level, like you are raising concerns you have about one? Whether the market power you have now allows for that space. You see, I'm raising this point because you've already given us a warning in the way you presented that you don't want a repeat of the past, and there may be such. Right? So I'm just checking as a person who sits there in the advisor where you need to advise. Is it your opinion? Has it ever been raised before so that it's looked at differently?
Honorable Chair, thank you. It depends on how the WOAN is going to be made up. Now, ICASA will invite applications from consortiums to bid for this license. And we don't know what the conditions for that license are going to be. At this stage, it's very vague. It says that it'll be a consortium. It could be that Vodacom and Telkom, for example, decide to form a consortium and to bid for this. Strictly speaking, the regulations say 30% HDI. So 30% of that license should go to historically disadvantaged groups. And that needs to be written into the license. Now, if you have a 30% shareholding, is it going to ensure meaningful participation? Is the money there from emerging players to make a meaningful contribution? And this will have to come out in the licensing process and the design of that that application to apply for the license. So those criteria would need to be set there, which we haven't seen at this stage. If you're going to compete at the service level, you need a lot less capital. Because remember, the WOAN is going to be a national network. And what the form of that national network is going to be remains to be seen. You take MTN and Vodacom, they have had more than 20 years to establish a national network. How long is it going to take this WOAN to establish a network? And the areas where the WOAN is needed are those areas where the big operators feel it's not economically viable for them to provide services. And this was exactly what happened with the underserviced area licensees. They were given licenses in areas where, at that stage, Telkom felt it was not economically viable to provide services. So this whole WOAN licensing process, first of all, as I say, I believe there needs to be an economic impact analysis and a proper economic impact analysis. I know there was a CS done on the white paper, but is that sufficient? We need an in-depth, comprehensive impact and assessment on the WOAN.
Thanks, Mr. Pepper. I think you've responded to the questions asked by members, and therefore thank you for engaging with us. I think it was also a learning exercise for a number of us in the committee, and I'm sure you have also been taking something back home. I'll just give you a minute to just make your closing point, understanding, yes, the time, like you would have requested. Yes.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. It was a pleasure interacting with you. I trust that I was able to give you some of the information you wanted. Honourable Chair, I believe that you do have my contact details, and I am at any stage willing to engage further via email or via phone with Honourable Members should they require information. And I thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. For all administrative matters, you'll interact with the support staff like you've done. Thank you.